answer. Soon you will have a Chinese baby sister who will surpass you academically.
I don't know about that. I'm considered pretty smart.
Well, Tibet was considered pretty independent. How'd that work out?
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul.
And I'm Simon Coronel.
This is potentially the last Macau session.
I think penultimate. I think we should do one more when it's your last week.
Yeah, we're going to try. But, it is your last week here in Macau. You're free. You get to go home.
I am.
How does it feel, Simon?
It is the weirdest feeling. I keep thinking of all these literary and fiction references to describe it, like waking up from a dream, like coming home from war. That's not a fair comparison. It's nothing like war. It's really...
You have a lot of vets angry.
Again, I was talking to someone about this. When your own personal Vietnam is working a job in entertainment with a decent apartment and an okay salary and a food allowance, you really have to stop and think about your perspectives on life.
Stop complaining.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's been one of the constant themes of the Macau sessions, is sort of shifting perspective, of getting really bogged down in something, then stepping back and looking at it from a different perspective and greater context of what it really is like. And there is definitely that part of it, looking at it still has been exhausting.
Yeah, it's a lesson in...
God damn.
You find out what your limits are. You find out, you know, even if you're given something you've worked for and something you're thrilled about, you still can find... frustrations and things,
and in
anything. Forgive me, I'm fighting a cold, and I just did two shows, and we're in between shows right now. We're going to do another show in an hour, so I will make even less sense in this podcast than I normally do. So I will try very hard.
I think we've touched on this before. It is, compared to all the things a human being might have to endure to make a living or to survive, this is, you know, this is very easy, but it is not freaking easy. This is hard freaking work. It's exhausting. It's emotionally draining. It's very intense. Very challenging.
Well, we were just talking about this. We're effectively doing a Broadway show schedule in that, you know, if you're on Broadway, you're doing 8 shows a week. Doubles on Wednesday, mm-hmm. doubles on Saturday, Sunday, in most cases, off Monday. So, you know, we're not starring in Macbeth or anything like that.
Mm.
So it's not grueling in that sense, but in terms of show load and workload, it's given me a great experience as to what that would be like.
Yeah.
You know.
And also, I mean, the other aspect of this is, as opposed to performing in a show that has a director and you're, you know, an actor or a dancer or a singer or a part of
somebody telling you what to do.
Yeah, there's more emotional investment in this. When you have a bad show, this hurts more because mm-hmm. it's all you. It's your baby. It's your, you've created these routines and these lines and this performance, and it's part of you. It's something you've nurtured and struggled over for years to bring to life. And when it doesn't, and when it fails to hit, you know, it's a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
And particularly when you're working to, you know, mostly incredibly less responsive audiences, which is, you know, generally what we're getting over here, with a few glorious exceptions, mm-hmm. the occasional fantastic crowd or fantastic person within mm-hmm. that crowd. I mean, I haven't done actual theater since, you know, high school, since way back. But I remember there's sort of that, you feel less responsible for it
mm-hmm.
as a whole. You're mm-hmm. responsible for your part of it. But if the whole thing flops, it's not like it's on you. Yeah. It doesn't hurt as much.
Yeah, less weight on your shoulders if you're in a production with multiple people. Yeah.
But then on the flip side, way more joy, visceral joy when something really hits and works brilliantly.
The highs are higher and the lows are lower. Yeah.
More extreme,
essentially,
but it's a surreal feeling to be.
And
to
I just want to point out, we're sitting in. They moved you into a nice hotel room for the week before you leave, and we're sitting out, literally gazing at. I say miniature Eiffel Tower, and it's not that miniature.
Half scale. I looked it up.
Okay, yeah, because it looks about half scale.
Yeah,
my sister who lives in Paris was unimpressed.
Wait a minute, in what way?
I don't think she was impressed.
It's only half scale.
She literally walks past the Eiffel Tower every day, and she's like, it's fine. It's very nice. I mean, it looks legit. It's nice. And we're looking out this window, 23 floors up.
Yeah, if you wanted to make a 50% scale Eiffel Tower, I do not see how you could do it better than this one.
I wrote down a few things. A lot of these were when I was in dark moments.
So there have been many of those.
But we've had a couple. It was a holiday here, so we had a bunch of bigger audiences and happier audiences and people who willingly purchase tickets to a show, and that always makes a difference as opposed to you got half off. So, a couple of good audiences was great, and we kind of this is something I wrote down. We've talked about the different types of audiences quite extensively on this little journey of the Macau sessions, but I've determined that there are three types of audiences: introverted, extroverted, and shitty. And I think that sums it up. I don't really need to. We've elaborated so much on audiences here, but if I could just put a cap on it over our past eight sessions,
I think you can. I think that almost actually becomes a four quadrant two axis thing. You've got introverted, extroverted, good or shitty. Because I've had introverted shitty and extroverted shitty.
Yeah.
The introverted shitty are the ones who just don't give a crap and are showing you with their face, just silently, sullenly sitting there resenting your existence. And then the extroverted shitty ones, the ones who are, you know, hassling you or trying to screw you up or just talking through it. Or
that was my show yesterday with three drunk Russian men. Just imagine stereotypical strong Russian man in an audience of very nervous Chinese people. And they're whistling, they're hooting, hollering. They're whistling to a point where it's just blaring. So I took a risk and I brought one of them up on stage, and it just made the audience more uncomfortable. It was good. It was one of those things of, I'm just going for it. And it shut them up, but it just made the Chinese people very, very uncomfortable.
I've had some surprisingly good crowds in the last few weeks, and I can't work out. I suspect it's a bit of both, but I think it's just because it makes sense. After 3 months of doing this 6 to 8 times a day, I'm better at connecting with them now. I understand the crowds. I understand the set. I understand the room. And I've noticed just, you know, every crowd varies. Some are really great. Some are terrible. You know, most are. But on average, I'm finding that the sets are going better. And again, because I have much more leeway in the act I'm doing to vary it up and mix it up and change it around. And I realized in hindsight, it's also actually easier in my room because I'm closer to the people. I'm down there on the floor with them, kind of doing basically an indoor circle street show, essentially. You know, semicircle, not actual circle. And so I can walk up to them, I can walk back, I can rearrange them, I'm much more connected to them than that. In that, there isn't that fourth wall. There's not even the possibility of a fourth wall, because there's no three walls.
And that's how magic should be presented, is close. It's in the same sense of stand-up comedy, just being essentially on top of the audience, so they feel
it's made me realize that. So I really feel changed by this experience in overall mostly good ways. It's one of those things that's been incredibly challenging, but I'm really glad to have done it, because I've learned a lot from this, and we'll wait and see if it plays out. That's also why I think it'd be fun to do a final one, to see, you know, so Simon's back in civilization now. What, you know?
Well, you're going after this to go perform on a cruise for some older white, English people?
Old rich white people.
Rich white people?
The demographics on the cruises tend to be, I've noticed it's mostly heavily U.S., British, Australian, and miscellaneous European,
so just
Canadian.
Polar opposite of what you're
completely.
And so you'll find out what works.
Well, it's weird. I go back to LA literally for slightly more, like about 26 hours. I land and then I go out of town for a day to go to a conference, and then I fly to this cruise ship gig, which is great. I would much rather have more time in LA, but that's truly a wonderful problem to have, is going straight back into work. That's again, because I've been doing this gig full time for 7 years now. And for the first 6 of those years, I really struggled to find enough work because, as we, you know, the sad truth is the quality of what you have to offer is not a good predictor of how much work you will get. Your strength in sales and marketing is the predictor. As long as you're an adequate performer, as long as your product is adequate, that's all you need. And then it's up to sales and marketing. And mine's always lacked. So 2017 is really the first year I've been doing magic full time where I've begun the year with a good pipeline of work.
Mm.
And it's a wonderful feeling because, again, when you've gone through the hard times, you really appreciate when it starts to be good.
Yeah.
Much like I think we're going to really appreciate getting back to the West. And I think we will be so much more appreciative of what it's like to perform there than anyone who hasn't done what we've done now.
I'm just going to be appreciative of going back to America. It's maybe the first time I felt American in my life. And I say that with zero irony, honestly.
Completely true. I have the same. It's when you leave your country to an alien culture, you suddenly begin to identify as your country just because of the contrast.
All the things I find troublesome with America in terms of certain personality types or the way people overindulge, just all these little nitpicky things that can get in your head and make you point fingers at people. Those are things I actually genuinely miss here because there's so many cultural things that we've just experienced on a day-to-day basis here that make you go, it's not that bad. It's okay.
Yeah.
If that soccer mom wants to pretend that Muslims are taking over the world in her cul-de-sac, it's okay. It's fine.
And she's definitely no more racist than the average person from mainland China.
No, that's in terms of racism.
Let's talk about China and racism.
It makes America's issue with cultural racism, skin color racism, whatever way demographic you want to look at it.
The different kinds of
it makes it so minute compared to here.
Compared to mainland China.
Just some of the simple conversations we've had.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's based on gender or whether it's based on where you come from in your nationality. So that's been eye-opening, and I like that. I should probably... I was going to write this out in a blog, but since we're on the topic here, let me see if I can find it. Maybe I lost it. It was just a thing. I was going to do a long blog of things I've learned in China, and you can contribute to this. ice water is confusing. They don't understand. I've been given many times when we say, can we have water? A cup of nearly boiling glass of water.
Yeah. Not recently boiled water.
Not in a coffee cup, but in a glass cup. Chinese people will find a way to walk into you even when no one else is around. You could be walking on the street, empty. One person will just find a way to walk into you. It's adorable. The Chinese thoroughly enjoy watching others fail. I believe that Schadenfreude was definitely born here first, as opposed to a German concept.
Gunpowder and Schadenfreude.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Voice text messages are all the rage.
Oh, yeah.
They love to talk into their text message. So, like, mini voicemails back and forth, which if you're sitting watching this go, pick up the phone! Make a phone call! What the hell? So that was fun, and I understand why that was now added to iMessage and things like that in the U.S.
For the Asian market.
We've talked about this before. Cab drivers hate their lives and you, but are really appreciative if you tip them an extra 10 mop, which is equivalent to $1.25. And let's see. If I give someone the card that has been produced from my mouth and I place it inside a Ziploc baggie, if I give it to them, there's a 90% chance they're either going to leave it in the theater or throw it away. But spitting into a public trash can is perfectly acceptable.
Or just spitting on the street.
Spitting on the street, yes. Fun little hilarious joy cultural things. There you go.
You've learned. The big thing that has really stuck in my head just about, you know, hashtag China is, you know, again, Macau being a special administrative region, it's not quite China, it's very China-y, it's a bit different, but I noticed that, did we talk about taxi seatbelts on this podcast yet? I don't think it came up. Forgive me if this is a repeat.
I think just everything is repeating, but
probably it's the same refrain
again
and again. Well, and honestly, that's part of it. This is the most repetitive, in good ways and bad ways. Repetition has good things and bad things about it. It's good in the predictability and the stability, and then it's bad in just the mindlessness of the repetition.
Sure.
This is the most repetitive my life has been for a long, long time. And one thing I've noticed about that is, and it's well documented, time moves quicker when every day is the same.
Yeah,
and this 3 months has flown by because of that. It feels like I blinked and I don't most of it's a blur because the same thing day in, day out, day in. And it makes it more dreamlike, you know, wondering if there's a world outside of this. And genuinely having brief instants of existential uncertainty. Wait, is there a world outside of this? Is there any? Did I have a life before this? What is that? Mm-hmm. And it's a split second, but it does creep in. But I forget where I was going with that. Taxi cabs. You get in a taxi, and we've noticed in Macau, all of the taxis have had the seatbelts removed from the back seats. They have the seatbelts in the two front seats. The seatbelts in the back seats, except in one taxi, I think, out of the hundreds, probably, tens, dozens at least, All except one, they've been removed. Now, sometimes the seat belts themselves have been removed. They're just not there. Sometimes the seat belts are there, but the buckles that you clip them into have been removed.
Nowhere to be found.
So what, through some mechanism, every taxi cab, the rear seatbelts have been actively disabled. Mm-hmm. Someone has gone to effort to disable the ability to use a seatbelt in the back.
And yet I will get yelled at if I sit in the front seat for not wearing my
seatbelt. Yeah, and that's because it's the law requires you to wear a seatbelt in the front seat. It does not require you to wear it in the back. That's fine. I think that's insane, but that's okay. At least that makes sense. What doesn't make sense is if you're not required to wear a seatbelt in the back seat, they would go out of their way to disable your ability to decide to opt to wear a seatbelt in the back seat. Now, that's already pretty weird. Where it gets weirder is I notice this because I wonder about these things. I like to discover the reasons for things in the world. And so I asked around. I asked, some Westerners who are here and some locals and some Macau locals and some China locals, hey, why have the seatbelts been disabled in all the cabs? Not one person knows. Not one person I've spoken to has any idea. Lots of people answered a different question, such as said things like, oh, well, it's not a legal requirement to wear them in the back seat. That doesn't answer the question. That answers a very different question. And some people have given various theories. No one knows. Not one person I've known. I actually got a friend to, because my Mandarin or Cantonese is good enough to ask a cab driver, got a local friend to ask the cab driver. He didn't know. The man who's driving the cab that has had the things, he doesn't even know.
So what you're witnessing right now is the mental breakdown of an Australian man who's lived in China for 3 months.
This is what this place does to you. And again, it's a mistake. And so I looked online. I went on Google. Why, found a thread on the China subreddit, on Reddit/China.
Of course, naturally.
And again, it was about mainland, but it applies to this. It's the same thing in the mainland. The cabs don't have seat belts in the back seat. And someone, again, had asked that same question. Again, got people answering different questions, giving unrelated information because they want to feel significant or whatever. And finally, one person replied with what, in hindsight, I realize I deep down knew was the answer all along, but just hadn't wanted to admit to myself. And replied with a short paragraph that displayed the greatest and deepest insight into China that I think I've seen in one comment, and showed that this person really understands China at a deep level, has clearly lived here and spent time here. And he said, the answer to why there are no seatbelts, I'm paraphrasing, is the same answer to any question beginning with why and involving China. The answer is, there is no fucking why, because it's fucking China. And if you haven't been to China, that will sound ridiculous or arrogant or whatever to you. But anyone who's lived in China will get that on it, will instantly feel the truth and wisdom in that. And I dug deeper into it, just getting into just China and looked up the history of it. You go back to, if you dig into the Cultural Revolution, the Hundred Flowers Campaign, the Great Leap Forward, there is the biggest thing that characterizes the problems here. There are many wonderful things about this place, right? There are many wonderful things about China, wonderful people I've met. Plenty of individuals are still wonderful. But the general cultural thing is that not that many decades ago, anyone who thought about things, the intellectuals, the artists, the creatives, anyone who thought, asked why, and thought, why are things the way they are? Maybe we could make them better in some way, was basically hunted down and either imprisoned, tortured, or killed. And hugely across the whole of China. You can see it lingers. There's an active resistance to thinking about things, or wondering about things, or having an inquisitive mind. And you see it. And there are plenty of individuals who are kind of breaking free of this mindset in recent history. And those are the people I found really enjoyable to talk to.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. Like there was this active campaign to just crush intellectualism back in, I think, about the 50s, 60s. And that's not that long ago. And you really see it lingers. This is all just because of taxicab seatbelts. This is what got me onto this deep investigation. And it's not like I didn't know that history, but I read much more into it. Not one person I've spoken to, and I've asked dozens of people now, had even thought about why there might be no seatbelts in the back, because that makes you way more likely to die. It's one of the most insane things out of many insane things I've seen here, that you don't even have the option to wear a seatbelt.
No, and when people say, what did you miss most about being home, I'll say critical thinking.
Yeah, completely.
Being able to just take A and connect it to B, because that's so hard for people to do here. Just in terms of, can I have a fork? What do you need a fork for?
Yeah, just this idea of, and again, obviously in America and Australia and the West, not everyone has good critical thinking skills, but the bell curve is so shifted to the other end that, you know, again, in America, the average server in an average crappy diner will have some critical thinking abilities. You talk to them, you're like, hey, is it possible to do this? And they will think about it. And they'll go, oh, yeah, right, I can see how a person might actually want that. And yes, I think that's probably doable, or that's probably not, and here's why. Whereas, again, while obviously people here can critically think, it's so rare. It's such a uncommon skill because, again, you look historically, it was actively stamped out of the culture. Yeah. Violently stamped out of the whole Chinese mentality.
Sure.
And it's slowly coming back, bit by bit. The culture is repairing itself and moving upwards, but damn. Sorry, that was quite a tangent.
Got dark.
Taxi cab seatbelts, guys.
Taxi cabs to history. Oh. It all makes sense to me. We were talking the other day about the five stages of grief, and we just renamed it the five stages of China. And yeah. I think in your last week here, you've emerged into the acceptance phase. Yeah. So there is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And I think we swapped a few of those around. I think we went denial, bargaining, depression, anger, then acceptance.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that was because like you begin with denial. You go, no, it can't be that insane. All these things Simon said on that podcast about how insane it is, that can't be right. He's just, you know, he's just an angry, you know, arrogant Westerner. And then you get here and you go, and you start to see it. And you're in denial at first. Then you start to realize, oh my God, it really is just absolutely insane here. And then, or is it you get to depression. Was that the way we did it? Bargaining first. Okay, no, maybe I can work around this. I can figure out a way to get through this. Then you realize, no, you can't. It's just good luck. It's going to be insane. You're never going to be able to get a fork or a vegetarian meal reliably. That just won't happen. Sometimes you will, but not reliably. And then you sink into depression and it just starts to get to you. And then you realize you start to come out of the depression with anger. You start to realize you feel justified in being angry. Because before, you know, you're trying to be respectful of another culture. And you feel, oh, it's on me. I should be adapting. I shouldn't be judging other people's cultures. And that's when you're just depressed because it's just hard and it's difficult. And everything's just stacked against you. And China will just find ways to fuck you, basically. And then you start to get angry. Whereas, no, you know what? This humans deserve better than this. Everyone here deserves better than what they're dealing with. We all deserve better.
I think that's hitting it right in the head there. You just start comparing it to the rest of the world and you start going, no, you deserve more. We are humans, gosh darn it.
Yeah. But and that's what I mean. My heart bleeds for the people I've met here. And again, and I'm, you know, obviously projecting more onto the mainland, but Macau obviously still has elements of that. The people who are thinking critically and are trying to actually improve their lives and improve the lives of those around them and find ways to make things better and more efficient and less corrupt and everything. And for them, oh man, it's at least we get to leave. You know, you and I get to leave. We're here for 3 months and then we can walk away. But most of them will never have the ability to, and they deserve so much better than this insanity. And the people who don't think, man, they don't even realize. You know, it's fine. Ignorance is bliss. Flowers for Algernon. But for those who are really sort of waking up. And
wait, who's the mouse in this situation?
We're all the mouse, Nick. We're all the mouse in some way or another.
Oh, dear.
And then you finally reach acceptance. You go, you know what? And hey, it is what it is. A few friends have visited over this trip, and I'm eternally grateful.
That's why we
didn't
do an episode last week, is A, we didn't really have much to say. B, Simon was so ready to go party. We let him go do it.
So. And I mean, the week before, no, a fortnight before that, I was just too sick. I was ill for about 9 days. I just got my ass kicked by some kind of cold flu that just wiped me out.
I'm getting that now.
Yeah. See, it's about 2 weeks delayed. But yeah, a good friend, shout out to Mike Costa, a writer, comic book and television writer extraordinaire, who was so good to have him here. Again, just as a voice of sort of, again, as a bearer of critical thinking.
Just somebody from L.A. Yeah, witnessing this spectacle and being able to process it in the same way.
I'm now sort of composing my sort of, you know, an article, a blog entry, just a piece about, you know, I wrote one saying, hey, I'm going to Macau, just to describe an easy way to communicate to people what I'm doing, because it's quite complex what we've been doing and I wanted to explain it in one place. And now I'm sort of writing my summary of, okay, what's next? And the thing I keep realizing is so much of it, I couldn't even begin to explain it adequately. And that was something that Mike really noticed while he was here. He made a lot of comments and we both agreed that He's going, I'm glad I came and I saw this because I wouldn't have understood. There's no, and he was thinking something similar. He wants to do a piece of writing about this place and about this whole thing. And he was just going, this is a brilliant writer. He's just, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to communicate what this experience has actually been in words, because without being here and seeing it and living within it, it's literally indescribable.
It's almost invisible of what the oddities that you experience. It's not something visually tangible most of the time.
And even just the House of Magic, even just what it is and the wonderful things and the absurd things and everything in between about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you've seen that Mega Magic show, you really can't describe it to someone. You can say what happens in it, but it's just nothing like sitting there in that audience and having it hit your visual field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if this transitions or not, but I just we were doing photos with people and then we had to stop because of management changes, things, business, I don't know. But was sitting in Starbucks and a kid and his dad came over. Or actually, there's a family. They're all kind of pointing and staring at me. And I waved, said hello. They walked away. And then as I was getting up, they came back and said if they could have a photo. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. And the dad goes, this photo is in case you become famous. And I don't take any offense to that. That is completely accurate. That is completely true. I know, and I do not want to be famous. That is not a thing I aspire to be. But it was so funny to me because this place, House of Magic in particular, pitches this. You're seeing the most famous magicians in the world. And this guy who had just seen the show left and said, just in case you become famous,
that is,
I want a photo with
yep.
you.
I think that elegantly captures a lot about
everything here. I'm not angry about it. Nope. I have no opinion one way or the other. It was just a perfectly illustrated moment of, yep, that's how the audiences are seeing this place. That's good. That's great. It's good that they don't hold us on a pedestal, but it was very funny.
How far through are we? I can't see the timing.
28:49.
Okay, we're good.
50.
I have a story that I want to end on, and so I'll leave it for...
That's good, because we have to get back and do another show.
We do another... How many... What are we... I've literally lost track each day. And I found actually one of the ways I get through the day is by not counting the shows. I deliberately sort of mindfulness meditate myself into not counting.
That makes it so much worse.
I look exactly one show ahead. It's just... I try very hard to just do that. It's sort of like... That's actually the way I learned to survive long-haul plane travel. You know, I fly mostly in Melbourne to LA and back and forth.
Just focusing an hour at a time.
Yeah. Well, also, on planes, I very deliberately don't look at my watch or a clock. I don't...
Yeah,
if I fall asleep and I wake up, I don't... excuse me. I don't check how long I've been asleep for.
Way to trick the brain.
Yeah, I aim to stay asleep forever. That's what I actually aim to on a plane. I'm just planning to stay asleep for as long as I can possibly stay asleep. And when I wake up, I try and stay in that, semi-comatose, half-wakeful, might fall back asleep, but if I don't, that's fine, just indefinitely, until I discover to my surprise that we've landed. That's the goal, is just aim. It's like Bruce Lee's theory in his book, and the Dragon film, aim all punches 2 inches beyond the intended point of impact. Because if you aim at, you can't actually hit 2 inches behind someone's sternum. But if you aim at beyond it, you'll hit that target with more energy than you would if you aimed at the actual surface of the target.
That's the title of your book, Punching People with Magic.
I'd go for more like 2 inches beyond. But, but that thing of aiming beyond the actual target point, so aiming to survive an infinite number of shows. And then suddenly 6 shows, you got there. It's all right. Whereas if you aim for 6 shows, by the time you hit that last one, you're just struggling.
Yeah.
Pacing yourself. It's not easy.
Yeah, you don't want to ever count out what, even if a regular job, just in terms of mental stability, you don't want to know, I got to do this at this time, and this and this time, and this and this time. You just take it a second, moment by moment, it makes it a lot easier mentally to comprehend.
Yeah. But also, and that's something that this has been an amazing experience for me particularly, is, and I look forward to seeing if this translates back to returning to the West, and I hope it will, I think it will, and I hope I won't be disappointed, that just the sheer intense repetitiveness of it, in order to survive, just in order to survive cognitively and not just turn into a dribbling mechanical lunatic, just parroting the same lines and the same bits again and again, is I've noticed that, and this is partly goes back to studying clowning theory and doing like a workshop with this genius called Dr. Brown, who's like a Goliath-trained clowning guy. It's a whole complicated long story, but really being present with the audience and focusing your attention onto what's happening in their heads during your show. Not thinking about what is the magic I'm doing, but what is the experience they are having, and engaging with that, because then every show really is completely different, and leaning into that and pushing that focus away from yourself and away from even what you're doing, instead to their experience of what you're doing. You know, this is not an original idea. This is a very basic idea, but it's one thing to understand that, another thing to start to live it and experience it. And I think at some point in the last month or 6 weeks or so, I started to hit much more of that. And that's, I've been surprised, really pleasantly surprised, by how much I haven't gone into robot auto mode of just, yep, next show, yep, same show. Each show has really felt, and again, that same thing of only looking at the next show, going, right, who are these people? Are they high energy? Are they low energy? Who are these people and how do I connect with them? And what can we create in this show that will be slightly different and unique from every other show?
Yeah, because I mean, this plays into what I was just going to say of there's a limit to the advantages having flight time gives you in terms of repeating the same stuff. But yeah, I experienced that, I think, yesterday with my 8:30 of getting in. You, if it's a gooder, if it's an easier crowd, you can get on that same mental wavelength with them and get into the moment, and it's not so much of a struggle. But I think you're absolutely right of so many people turn their focus towards what they're doing. Instead, you should turn it outward towards the audience, and that makes a big difference.
Well, I can't remember where I heard this. You see sort of the gradient, you see most performers, particularly magicians, but not, you know, comedians and acrobats and everything as well, but particularly magicians, because it's a very self-driven, solitary, introspective art form generally. Most of them are performing at the audience, at them. They're not, you know, they're thinking about themselves and they're thinking about their act and their, you know, their attention, you can tell their attention is, how am I looking? Am I cool? I'm doing magic. How's it going? And then you graduate from at to performing to the audience. You're actually performing to them. You're seeing who they are and you're performing to them as whoever they are, rather than just at the wall, throwing it at the wall mindlessly. But then, and this was a lot of sort of the good clowning theory, was you graduate from performing to the audience to eventually performing with the audience, genuinely creating this show, the experience of the show in partnership with them. Because seeing what they give back to you and then noticing that, letting them see that you've seen that, and really building the show with them, even though obviously their role is far more passive than yours, it really is that sense of togetherness, of we're doing, you know, you're doing the show with them, together with them, rather than to them or at them. And that's really sort of helped me a lot. And that's always something I've wanted to tap into, and this experience has been amazing for that. Just again, because out of almost sort of emotional necessity to avoid the repetitiveness, it sort of sought me reaching for that,
and
which
that's
I always found
why
hard to
access. Live performance will persist in the internet age. I've talked to people that are a couple years older than me. They're genuinely nervous about it, and they don't know where it's going to go. But I think just that element of it being a back and forth experience, something everybody gets to experience in that moment, is what will hopefully keep live performance, you know, alive and well.
We can but hope.
I'm cautiously optimistic about it. But if not, I don't know. I'll go be a bank teller or something. That's fine, too.
Yeah.
I have
a story that ends on a bright note, because I like this. So when some friends from Hong Kong, my friends YC and John and Elaine, came over while Mike was here as well, and they came to see the show. And they came to see several shows because we were just hanging out, and I was showing them, you know, backstage and what a day in the life is at the House of Magic and giving them the real behind the scenes tour, because they're all magicians. They get it. It's glorious to have someone who will understand what you're showing them and really actually get it, you know, grok it for fans of Stranger in a Strange Land. And they came and we were hanging out the front of the show, and I was just still in my costume, my ludicrous steampunk costume. And we were hanging out. They'd already seen the show a couple of times and, you know, knew what was up. And we were hanging out just drinking tea or something that we got from the tea shop. And we saw this little girl. She was, I don't know, probably 7 years old-ish. I'm very bad at kids' ages. It's not my market. And she looked at me, and just this look of excitement and amazement on her face. You could tell she was thinking, oh, my God, this it's the magician. It's a magician. You know, she'd seen the photos or something. And she was just so amazed and delighted and stunned. You're sort of awed, like, gasp, this gasping smile on her face. And already it just felt great. And then I basically, you know, ni hao, ni jin tian hao ma, you know, just said, hey, how are you in Mandarin? And she now looked, if this was even possible, even more astonished. It's like, and clearly a white person speaking Mandarin was also amazing to her. So not only is she seeing a real life magician in front of her, but also a Mandarin speaking, she was just stunned. She was just on this insane high and just wanted to interact. And I said, you know, in Mandarin, you're seeing the show, I'll see you inside. And she just looked, again, so excited. She was just high on life. And so we went in and my friends had seen that and they were thinking paper balls. And it's like, oh yeah, she's going to be the volunteer for the paper balls routine, which is the most interactive part in the show, and it needs a kid. And you ideally want a kid who's going to enjoy it. And she was just so perfect, like by far the most obviously perfect choice in the entire 300 shows. Just yes, it's absolutely going to be her because she's going to love it. And it's just going to be great to see how much she loves that. So we do the show. I bring her up. I say, you know, in Mandarin, are you willing to help? And she just, again, she's just so, yes, just, oh God, yes. She's so excited to help out. She comes up. I do the routine. She just trips out. It's, you can tell this is just one of the most mind-blowing experiences of her life. Who knows why she was so tripped out by magic and Mandarin-speaking white people. And so she goes back, and just as she left, she was just talking to her mother, just losing her shit, just going, oh my God, this is amazing. And as she walked away, my friends were commenting just, wow. Just wow, that she was incredible. Just the kind of audience member you dream of. And it occurred to me that number one, it's a great feeling to be able to bring that much joy to another human being. Because you don't always, right? A lot of the audiences just don't give a shit and we don't reach them and they walk away still sullen. But every now and then you get to bring that much joy to somebody and it's the best feeling. But it also occurred to me that that girl will now walk away and go through her life and she will never ever know that she brought just as much joy to me and to them. She will never know that. We know how much brought joy.
Cue audience awe moment.
Yeah.
In three sitcom
but style. Like, I will remember that little girl. She'll remember that for the rest of her life, but she'll never know that I will remember her for the rest of my life. Just because when you're struggling and audiences are often mediocre, damn, those moments are great.
Yeah, those moments change. They change you and they keep you going and they are, to sound cliche, they are the magic moment. Yeah,
but
if you weren't doing magic, I would still say that.
And it just got me thinking about that, and that's true of way more than just magic. You know, there is now a little girl walking around there who will never know just how special she was to some random stranger who she'll never see again in her life. Mm-hmm. But and so many people have moments like that. You know, some random stranger who did something for them, and that person will never know how much, you know, the right thing at the right time when someone just really needed a kind word and someone randomly gave them one, just little things that really make a difference. You'll never know how significant you might be to somebody's life.
Yeah, and those are those little Santa Claus moments that, you know, vindicate some of the awful, terrible things that happen in just in
the goddamn taxi seatbelts. What the fuck, Macau? Jesus.
We came from extreme cynicism to pure heart and joy, and then still it goes back.
And that's
to
the
that.
Point. It's the yin and yang. It is reality. Is all these things. It's neither good nor bad. It's both. It's everything. It's, you know, nothing.
But that's. I mean, that's why
it's existence.
It's existence. That's why you do this. You're just constantly searching for those moments, and I assume you weren't looking for it when that happened. It just crept up on you.
It happened.
But that's a gift unto you, and that's something you get to keep in your pocket at all times. So if you are experiencing a shitty crowd, just go, you know what? I made that little girl happy, and that
she
little
was
girl made
so
me
so damn happy.
And that's how if you have a shitty audience, you need to just scream at the audience. Go, you know, I made a little girl happy yesterday.
Yeah, but you know what? That won't even make a difference to them because they don't care, and you can't expect them to. You move on.
Yeah, it's why I've had to stop myself from. I'm proud to say I'm getting pretty good at it, where I don't get mad at quiet crowds.
Yeah.
But there are those moments where you just want to just scream at them. Just like, why are you here? Why are you watching this?
I have noticed that you do struggle with crowd rage.
I do.
More than many people I know.
I do, because I take it personally. But I'm going to give you this some contract. If there's anything I've gained from this contract, it's being able to handle that and being able to accept, all right, it's fine.
And there's nothing like that intensity of frequency to do that. Just bombarded with it just again and again. And you find you have to adapt or you'll just go literally insane.
The audience owes you nothing, as we've talked about before. That child owed you nothing, but you were able to find a gift in a magical, wonderful moment, and that's something you'll be able to keep with you. And that's all we're doing. We're just going to the next show. You may be going onto a boat after this. You may be doing something else. But the whole point is going from moment to moment and just trying to live truthfully under imaginary circumstances.
Yeah. Or to paraphrase our favorite Rick and Morty, our favorite show, Rick and Morty, or is it nothing makes sense, no one belongs anywhere, we're all going to die, let's go do a magic show.
Yeah, that's it. And that is the Macau Sessions. Bye-bye, everyone.
Peace out.